And then it occurred to me, what luck.
Okay.
I swore a solemn vow.
Years ago, I was invited to a party.
And I remember there was a band playing.
Welcome back to the third installment of Exfabula Story Stage U. I'm your host, Exfabula co-founder Leah Delaney. Exfabula connects storytellers with live audiences in Milwaukee. We provide a mic, a stage, and a theme for the night. You provide the stories. Many of those stories revolve around a moment of change or decision, and for this show, we found a few stories from several events when that moment was death-defying. We'll start off today's show with an audience favorite story by Drew Braille, who defied death several times in one short night.
I should not be here tonight. I should be dead. I was in the luckiest accident in automotive history. And this is how it happened. Years ago, I was invited to a party, and a friend of mine, whom I'll call Julius, swung by my house to pick me up to drive me there. I didn't know how to drive yet, which is important, as you'll see later. So we're driving down the freeway to this party, and we get into a conversation, and the subject kind of wanders onto how we both have this amused contempt for small talk, and how some people feel the need to fill a perfectly good silence with meaningless, empty words, and how we're both trying to break ourselves of this habit. We were both freshmen in college at the time. So we make our point and we lapse into a kind of smug silence for the next couple of miles because nobody's going to break it, you see, because that'd be weak. Now, before I forget, I should tell you that I have no idea where this party is or how to get there. I'm entirely relying on Julius to know the way. So after a couple more minutes of this, I decide to be the big man and I say, "Why, we sure are getting good at avoiding small talk, aren't we?" And Julius says nothing. So I think, okay, this is the way he's going to play this, huh? So I shut up again and smile for another couple of miles, and we're driving down the freeway, and finally I get fed up, and I throw up my hands, and I say, "Okay, Julius, you win. You're better at silence than I am." And he still says nothing, just keeps driving, looking straight ahead. In fact, it's not until after we get off the freeway and then get right back on the freeway, and I ask him, "Julius, are you sure you know where we're going?" And he still doesn't say anything, that I begin to suspect that something might be wrong. Or I'm just getting pissed off. I can't remember which. Now, what I didn't know at the time, what Julius himself didn't know at the time, is that Julius has epilepsy. And he's having what the doctors call a brownout. He's not a blackout. He's still conscious. He just isn't quite all there. He's driving perfectly normally, staying within the lines, going the speed limit, obeying all the other rules of traffic, but he just doesn't have any idea where he's going or why, and he obviously doesn't have any interest in conversation. But I can't tell, because aside from getting off and on the freeway, he's driving perfectly normally, I don't know where we're going, and because we've had this conversation, I think he's just being a jerk. So I don't panic, which is important. So eventually we get off the freeway again, and now we're in city traffic, and it's night, it's dark, and there's a big intersection, and there's a red light ahead of us, and there's a car stopped at that red light straight ahead of us, and there's another vehicle in the lane to our right. And Julius, brownout or no, can see the red light, knows it means stops, put his foot on the brake, but he doesn't put it on quite vigorously enough, and we rear-end the car in front of us at the intersection. A little. So here's the luckiest accident in automotive history. We rear-end the car in front of us, but one, nobody gets hurt. Two, the car in front of us is so little damaged that when the light turns green, the driver just drives off. He never gets out of the car to swap insurance numbers. Three, the car that Julius is driving is damaged in just such a way that when the light turns green and he puts his foot on the gas, because he's still not reacting to anything, and now I'm really starting to freak out, he puts his foot on the gas, the car won't start. Must have dislodged the flenser valve or something. And four, the vehicle in the lane to our right, remember, is an ambulance. So the EMTs pile out of the car and they check to see if everybody's all right and notice that something's seriously out of whack with Julius, and they shine lights in his eyes and give him orange juice and restore him and generally save the day. So let's take stock. One, if Julius had had a blackout on the freeway instead of a brownout, death. Two, if we hadn't had this conversation or I knew where we were going and I had realized that something was seriously wrong and had panicked, Remember, I don't drive, trying to grab the wheel or do the brakes or something. Death. If he had not put on the brakes at all and just rear-ended the car ahead of us, possibly death. If the car had been able to go when the light turned green, off we go into city traffic, death, possibly multiple deaths. But nobody gets killed, nobody gets hurt. Julius is diagnosed and treated, is never put in this situation again or puts anybody else in this situation again. As far as I'm concerned, the ambulance and lane to our right is just fortunate icing on a very lucky cake.
That story was told by Drew Braille at Moe's Irish Pub in March 2010, where the theme was luck. Like many tellers, Drew showed up that night ready to tell a story and put his name in the hat hoping to be drawn. He was the first randomly selected volunteer storyteller. As luck would have it, that same night, the next storyteller who was also chosen at random from the hat, right after Drew Braille, also had a death-defying lucky moment to share with the audience. Here is Grant Hagen.
Drew, you stole my story. I have the luckiest helicopter crash accident. When I was 21, I got to spend a year in South Vietnam flying helicopters. Sometimes you get lucky when you fly helicopters, and you're on the maintenance duty. 50 helicopters all lined up, guys jumping into helicopters, getting flown somewhere, dropped off, empty helicopter comes back, grabs some more guys, going, they don't come back, the helicopters do, load up, go. I was lucky, I was on maintenance duty. We string the hammocks inside the helicopter, break out some cokes and smokes, sit around waiting for somebody's helicopter to break. We arranged for the tow truck for helicopters. The tow truck for helicopters is a great big Chinook helicopter. Comes down, grabs the top of it right by the rotor blades, and pulls it away. Somebody's got to get the helicopter ready. I have those four guys sitting in the back of my helicopter, playing cards, drinking soda, smoking. Nothing's going on until the magic phone rings, Kingsman 1-1. Go get somebody's broken helicopter ready. We load up, four crew members, pilot, me, co-pilot, my roommate, two gunners in the back, and four maintenance guys. These guys are mechanics. They're not soldiers. They have uniforms on, but they don't have guns. They have wrenches. We load up, we go fly, they say, okay, this helicopter is parked on the side of this little hill over there, something was wrong, all the people are gone, somebody else took them away. We fly out there, big helicopter in the sky telling us what's going on. He says, okay, your two Cobras are on station now. And I asked him, two Cobras, do we need Cobras for this? Cobras are the big, scary attack helicopters, rockets, machine guns, cannons, and all this stuff. We're mechanics today. We shouldn't need any Cobras. Cobras are on station. Okay. We're coming in to land. We see the helicopter sitting there. We hear machine guns. Think, this is good. A second later, my co-pilot hears the Cobras say, okay, we're gonna start shooting now. I looked over, you heard machine guns. I heard machine guns. We're almost ready to land. Now we hear machine guns all around the parked helicopter. Just like in the movies, explosions happening. The dashboard of your helicopter, all the lights are on. Hearing weird noises. This isn't good. We dive over the side of the mountain and go into what's called an auto rotation. Airplanes want to fly. Helicopters don't. Helicopters want to crash. When your power steering is out on your car, it's not easy to fly a helicopter. When you don't have any hydraulics, none of the parts work very well, but much military training gets you ready for an auto rotation. The rotor blade spins, builds up lift, you get one shot at landing on the ground, or actually landing above the ground, and if you learned your lessons, well, you'll be all right. In a car crash, the guy in front of you stops you, smack him. In a helicopter crash, all things go slower. It takes 2 minutes to hit the ground when all your engine is shot and you're auto-rotating. As we get down to the bottom, machine gun holes are appearing in the windshield. Parts are starting to fall off the side. We're pretty scared. Helicopters will stop with all your inertia built up in the rotor blades. You pull everything, you do it just like in the book, and you stop perfectly this far above the grass. In Vietnam, the grass is 18 feet tall. Boom! Rolls over. 8 of us scramble out of the side of this thing. If you've seen a John Wayne movie, you've heard that zing of bullets. It's real. Zing, zing. We run along the beach, or I'm sorry, along the trail to the river. Another helicopter picks us up. All 8 of us get in his helicopter, 68 hits in his, nobody touched.
You just heard a story told by Grant Hagen at our event held last March, where the theme was luck. I'm Leah Delaney, and death-defying is the theme for today's radio stories from various Exfabula events of this past season. The next piece is told by Jeannie Dean, retelling a fight-or-flight moment in her life, which turns out to be truly death-defying.
Well, a stranger in a strange land. Sometimes when you're a stranger, you can have an influence on a situation for the good more than if you were an insider. And I had that happen to me when I was 18, and I was hanging out with heroin addicts. I was in love with Popeye. That was his street name, and he had big forearms, and that's how he got his name. His real name was Ron. Ron was a Vietnam vet and recovering addict on methadone. And he had left a promising career at Juilliard School as a concert pianist when he was drafted. So he was pretty special. Ron and I used to walk along the bluffs on Lake Michigan. There was a lot more trees there then. One day we found an apple tree, and he shimmied up and shook down the apples, and these perfectly ripe, red, yellow, golden apples fell into my hands, and they were the best apples I ever ate in my life. That day was the day he told me that he'd been a sniper in Vietnam, and, you know, he lived in the trees, picking off people. Sometimes when we'd go back in the bluffs, he would go into post-Vietnam, you know, they call it traumatic stress disorder now. There wasn't a name for it then. But he would climb the tree and start reliving memories and talking in Vietnamese, and I'd have to leave him. It was moments like that I could understand why he had taken up with heroin. One day I went over to see Ron, and he said, "Jeannie, we got to go over to Sue's house. Her boyfriend got out of jail. He escaped out of Milwaukee County Jail, and he's looking for her. We got to help her. She wants to get away before he finds her." So we go over there, and we're packing her stuff, you know, the dishes and pictures, and Jack comes pounding on the door. "Sue, open up. Let me in. I got to get my stuff." She looks at Ron, and he says, "Yeah, give him his stuff." So she opens the door a crack and says, "Here's your stuff. Get out of here." And he pushes his way in and starts grabbing her and say, "Sue, you got to come with me. I'm driving to Arizona. I'm going right now." She's saying, no, I broke up with you. I'm done. I'm not going to go on the run with you." And he's getting more agitated. He's calling her names and saying, "Get your stuff, bitch. Come on. You're going with me." And then all of a sudden, he pulls out a gun. And there I am, 18, country girl, just moved to the hot east side, aspiring poet, dreamer, idealist. And there's this guy with a gun. And it's like something Clint Eastwood would have. It's huge. And I'm thinking, this is not my reality. I was, you know, really known. I was a stranger in a strange land that moment. And at the same time, I knew with the conviction you can have at 18 that there was no way, no way there was going to be a shooting with me there. There was no way that woman was going to be on the floor bleeding. And I just stepped forward and I said, "You're not going to shoot her. You're not going to shoot her." And then I'm like talking logic and reason. I'm saying, you know, you love her. You know, if you shoot her, she'll be dead. She can't go with you. And you love her. And she seizes the moment. You know, she grabs hold of me. And she stands behind me. And she's right there. And she's shaking. And she's panicked, as anyone would be. And she's saying, "Yeah, Jack. Yeah, you're not going to shoot anybody. Yeah, Jack." And I realize I'm a human shield. I'm standing between this woman and a bullet. And, you know, I still didn't lose my conviction. I'm looking at Jack's face, and I'm seeing him, not the gun. Still wasn't my truth that anything was gonna happen. And he's dumbfounded. He's totally dumbfounded. He's like, "Where did you come from, and who are you?" And so Ron, being a soldier, sees what to do, and he says, "Come on, man, give me the gun. Put the gun down. You know nothing's gonna happen. Give me the gun." And he glides over to him, you know, talks gentle. And this Jack just kind of folds, and he drops the gun in Ron's hand. And then Ron puts his arm around him and says, "Come on, you know, you gotta get out of here. The cops are gonna be looking for you. You know they're gonna come here." And he walks him to the door and sends him on. When the door closes, Susan turns and looks at me and says, "You know, you saved my life." And I didn't think I had. I didn't really think I had. I knew I was a stranger in that world, though, that day. This world of ex-cons and drug users. But I think Ron respected me a little more, that I could walk in his world and not really be part of it. And I never saw Sue again. I don't know what happened to her. And Ron died of a brain tumor. And now I wonder, could I have that same conviction now that evil is not going to happen in my presence? Thank you.
You just heard Jeannie Dean telling us about a death-defying moment at our Exfabula event back in April, held at the Stonefly Brewery in River West. The theme was Stranger in a Strange Land. We would like to wrap up today's show with a story told by another first-time Exfabula storyteller, Karen Kohlberg, who garnered up the courage to tell us her very personal death-defying story.
Imagine you're standing up on stage, kind of like this, and you're reciting your favorite poet, your favorite spiritual poetry. And all of a sudden you start sweating and forgetting. And it's 3/4 of the way through the poetry concert, and you're not quite sure what to do. So you cut the concert short, and you step off stage, and you decide, okay, it's kind of it's freaky, but I'm going to be all right. You put your head on the table, and you can't lift your head off the table. And that's exactly what happened to me at Club Timbuktu. I was performing, and I didn't know what was going on, so I got whisked back home. My brother was there, and he whisked me back home, and I ran up the stairs tearing off my clothes, and I proceeded to lose all bodily function. I mean, it was really messy. And I won't go into details, but I lifted my head off the bathroom floor, and I asked my brother, "Am I dying?" And in the ambulance ride to the hospital, I realized I was. But it wasn't so much dying, which is amazing to me. It was dissolving. There was no sense of fear. There was no peace. There was no concept. There was no ego. There was no Karen left in terms of being able to say, "This is Karen and this is what I'm feeling." There was nothing. And when I woke up in the morning after having brain surgery, I realized I was paralyzed on the right side. I couldn't walk. I couldn't talk. I couldn't do anything. I was a helpless mess. they were actually charting my bowel movements. You know, I had never gotten applause for that before. It's like, oh boy, look what Karen could do. So I was in the hospital for 6 weeks, in therapy for about 6 months or so, and it was now or never because they were holding my job open for 3 months more, and that was it. So I could have fallen deeply into depression and felt like I often did where it came over me, and I just couldn't quite pull myself out until I decided finally it was now or never. I had to either do it or die, because part of me had died already. You know, why not the other part? So what I did was I decided to pull myself up by my bootstraps, even if it was with one arm, and, you know, go for it. I was going to go for it, and I went for it in a big way. I decided to use all of the skills that I ever had, and I was going to take those skills and I was going to utilize them as much as I could. 35 years of juggling. 35 years. What was that all about? I couldn't even open my hand to hold a ball, let alone toss it. I decided it wasn't the juggling, it was the discipline. So I started with the littlest movement. What about that unicycling? I've been up on a unicycle. I get up and I fall off and I get up in Lake Park, you know, hours and hours. It was so much fun. This is my chance to use that wheelchair. Okay, so I started to, okay, how can I do this with one arm and not go into circles, you know, and make it more fun? So that was part of it too. As being up on a 6-foot unicycle, juggling clubs up there, that was nothing, you know, even on stilts, the slack rope, all those kinds of circuit skills I developed all those years with Friends Mime Theater was nothing compared to trying to drive again. Can you imagine wondering if your body and brain are going to work together to drive? I mean, I know brain surgery really didn't do much for me in terms of my driving. I'm still a maniac on the road, although one thing happened though, it is so much energy to lift my arm, I can't flip anybody off anymore. So that was a really good thing that happened. And my mime was great. It's like standing in store windows like this for hours. Okay, I could do that real easily now, you know, but it was the incremental movements that were, you know, it's like a victory. Every single movement I made with one little hand. And then the comedy, you know, having co-founded Comedy Sports, you know, where's the comedy now? Where can I find the comedy in all of this? And you know, it came to me when I was trying to make those doctors laugh. And so, you know, I had a fish hat on my head and I was wheeling around looking for the surgeons so that they would ask me, what you got on your head? And I say, a neurosurgeon, you know, and got them to laugh though. And all that poetry that I memorized, 150 poems that I memorized, gone in a flash. But now I have 275 poems in my head, and I'm going for 365. So there was one poem that I remembered out of those 150, one poem that I grab a hold of, and I know that the mystics can reach across time and space and help you heal. And it goes like this, and I'm going to give you the shortened version. I know the voice of depression still calls to you. I know those habits that can ruin your life still send their invitations. But you're with a friend now, and you look so much stronger. You can stay that way and even bloom. Keep squeezing drops of the sun from your work and prayers and from your companion's beautiful laughter. Keep squeezing drops of the sun from the sacred hands and glance of your beloved and, my dear, from the most insignificant movements of your own holy body. Now, sweet one, be wise. Cast all your votes for dancing. So coming up here tonight, I'm casting yet another vote for dancing.
That was Karen Kohlberg telling her story the night the theme was Now or Never at the Bayview Brew House. Xfabula is gearing up to bring you another season of Milwaukee Storytelling. This show is just a sampling of the range of stories that emerge from people like you at an Xfabula Storytelling event. If you want to tell a story or be a part of our supportive audience, head over to xfabula.com for more information about our upcoming season and our late summer smaller storytelling events. My name is Leah Delaney, and I would like to thank you for tuning in to Xfabula Radio. Xfabula Radio was produced and edited by Xfabula co-founders Leah Delaney and Amy Schleicher, along with Jeremy Kuzniar, Tom Crawford, and Ryan Schleicher of WMSE. For more information on Xfabula storytelling and details of upcoming events, head over to xfabula.com. We'll be back next month to share more stories here on WMSE Frontier Radio. My name is Leah Delaney, and I would like to thank you for tuning in to Exfabula Radio.